Good morning. Good Thursday morning. It's 9 o'clock in the West Coast of the United States. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know because this is Press Watch. And I'm very glad to be here. And before I even get started today, I want to thank my ever so patient and brilliant engineer who is just absolutely always on top of things and right now is trying to call my interview subject for this morning, Dennis Lambert. My third candidate interview running for the Green Party presidential primary, but I'll get to him in just a moment. I want to pass on a few brief news items first. This from Newsweek, of all places. Senator Bernie Sanders leads President Donald Trump by the widest margin of all the candidates in the Democratic Party's 2020 race. When Americans are asked to choose in a face-off against the Republican incumbent, according to a poll, Survey USA, they write, asked 4,000 and change registered voters nationwide how they would vote in an election today. If Trump was pitted against each of the 2020 candidates in the Democratic race, the progressive Vermont Independent came out on top. The poll found that 52% of voters would choose Sanders and 43% Trump, giving the veteran senator a 9-point lead. Next was Biden at 50% to Trump's 43%. And so there's more to that article and a listing of how the other Democrat candidates stack up. So you can find that. And also today, I found this just before I came in, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has updated their doomsday clock. And, well, they didn't push it back. They pushed it forward. And they write, humanity continues to face two simultaneous existential dangers, nuclear war and climate change. They're compounded by a threat multiplier, cyber-enabled information warfare that undercuts society's ability to respond. The international security situation is dire, not just because these threats exist, but because world leaders have allowed the international political infrastructure for managing them to erode. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists was founded in 1945 by University of Chicago scientists who had helped to develop the first atomic weapons in the Manhattan Project. And you may recall references to the Doomsday Clock from the movie Watchmen and the subsequent TV series. But it is a real thing, and they have moved it to 100 seconds to midnight. So less than 2 minutes to midnight on the doomsday clock. And they write, in the nuclear realm, national leaders have ended or undermined several major arms control treaties and negotiations during the last year, creating an environment conducive to a renewed nuclear arms race, to the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and to lowered barriers to nuclear war. Political conflicts regarding nuclear programs in Iran and North Korea remain unresolved and are, if anything, worsening. U.S.-Russia cooperation on arms control and disarmament is all but non-existent. Now, they won't say this, but a good chunk of this is due to Trump, who scoffs at international treaties. And it is because of the scoffing at international treaties by Trump and others in the who are beholden to the war industry. That the treaty binding certain weapons lapsed, and Russia created the nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed hypersonic cruise missile, which now changes the strategic balance, so to speak. And that is one of the things that has prompted the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists to say that it's 100 seconds to midnight now, and not just not just 2 minutes to midnight, which is pretty dire. And I think that it's something that should be taken to heart because we don't talk about nuclear war anymore, and most people think that the threat is over. It most definitely is not, and it's getting worse. And, of course, there is the situation with North Korea, which is also worsening. Well, now, if the lines are working, I'm hoping to talk to Dennis Lambert. Dennis Lambert for President 2020. Are you there, Dennis?
Yes, sir, I am.
Thank you very much for joining me. I am actually transgender, and I use a baritone voice on the air, so you don't need to call me sir. I spoke with, not that you would know. I mean, how would you know? But I spoke also earlier with Sednam Moyowasifsa-Curry, and I talked with Howie Hawkins, and they all got their 25 minutes, so now You do as well. And your candidacy is for the Green Party's nomination to run for President of the United States, and that convention is coming up in a few months, I think July. So what preparations has your campaign made so far?
Well, so far we've made it on the ballot in California and Texas. Unfortunately, the way the Green Party has organized the presidential election and the recognition this year is they've added financial requirements, which I found quite disturbing, as we're supposed to be the party that's supposed to be getting money out of politics.
That's something they didn't do before?
Yeah. It's something that they created last year and instituted last year without giving the candidates enough fair time warning in advance.
How much cash have you been able to raise for your run?
It's around $3,000, I believe.
So this is a shoestring effort compared to other presidential campaigns. You were in the military, and you participate in efforts to support the lives of veterans. Is that right? Can you detail those efforts?
Well, my previous job for the last 6 years was helping veterans with employment issues, but we also initiated programs to help them overcome other individual barriers to self-reliance, such as creating partnerships with housing organizations to rehouse homeless veterans. We created a partnership with an organization to provide furniture. We started our own food pantry, and within the first year of operation, we became the largest veterans food pantry in the state of Ohio. The last year I was working for them, we provided over 16,000 meals to veterans and family members throughout the areas where I was serving, just in five counties. We developed a lot of different partnerships to provide resources to our veterans who were coming out of drug addiction treatment or homeless programs. So if a veteran came to me who was homeless, we could find him a house or an organization that would provide him with housing assistance within 3 days.
How do you feel about military recruiting now? How would you advise someone looking at the military as an option?
I would tell them to take a look at how they're treating the veterans now. Prior to working with this nonprofit organization helping veterans with these other issues, I was actually filing claims for veterans' disability benefits. So I became very well familiar with the barriers that the VA puts in front of veterans to prevent them from getting the assistance that they need based on their sacrifice for the country or for during their service. If somebody was to want to join the military now, I would say definitely look at how they're treating the veterans now. And if you go into any branch, I would recommend the Air Force, because there's less chance that you're going to get killed in combat or have any other issues that the ground pounders, 11 Bravos, what the infantry is in the Army, but the people who are on the front lines are experiencing. In fact, a friend of mine from Boy Scouts just retired from the Air Force, and he filed a disability claim for his knees, and within 1 month of him being out, the VA had lost all of his paperwork for his claim. So okay. He had to resubmit it.
So you're helping people with that sort of thing?
Yes, yeah. I would not recommend anybody join the military now, especially since there's a continued expansionist wars for regime change, and it's just not I use it primarily to repay the government. I grew up one of five children raised by a single mother, and we got food stamps and other government assistance. So in my heart, I felt I wanted to give back to my country, as well as find a way to pay for college. And unfortunately, that's the big hook nowadays.
That's the reality, the economic draft, huh?
Yeah. When I joined, the biggest bonus you could get was about a $5,000 bonus. Now they're giving out $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 bonuses for people who join the military. So in areas where I live, where it's economically depressed and most jobs are paying $8 to $10 an hour, it's really the only viable option for a lot of the kids coming out of this area.
Yeah, that's a down payment for a house.
Yeah. Well, $30,000. In my area, you can buy a whole house for $30,000.
Well, I want to ask you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So really, it as an economic imperative, based on our capitalist system, it's the only option for, I would say, 40-50% of the kids that are graduating high school in this area if they don't go someplace else, and most of them don't have the money to move someplace else.
Yeah, and 30K for a house, that's interesting. I didn't know it was like that. What town are you talking about with those prices?
Well, I live in a small bump of the road called Pedro, Ohio. P-E-D-R-O, spelled Pedro, but pronounced Pedro. In Ironton, Ohio, which is along the Ohio River. I'm just 12 miles up from the river. Ironton, Ohio, even Chillicothe, Ohio, which is about 60 miles north of us, you could buy a house for $30,000, $40,000.
Wow. I have heard of Chillicothe. Well, I would like to read your statement from your, let's see, website. I'm not sure of the platform, but I want to see what you have to say about it. Quoting, it says, "I run because no matter who the nominee on either side in 2020, it will be the party who is declared the winner of the election. We will then start another cycle of obstruction and animosity that will see legislation passed that benefits businesses with no regard for the needs of the American people," end quote. So can you expand on that?
I have not seen any benefit from electing a Democrat or Republican on any level of government for the last 30 years that I've been really deeply paying attention to politics. So I don't see any difference between the Democrats and Republicans. You know, it may be minor talking points where the Democrats believe in climate change, but some of them don't believe it's man-made, and the Republicans absolutely refute it because 3% of scientists who are purchased by corporations for their research don't agree with it. So we need a major revolution to take our government back from these special interests who are bribing the elected officials to keep running. It's a money game. They just, as long as the money's flowing to the Democrats and Republicans, they will not do anything to help the poor and working class Americans.
I have said similar things myself, and then came Trump, and so I want to follow up on that a little bit. Have you been following the impeachment proceedings? Do you think the Democrat Party is handling it correctly?
No, they didn't go after everything they could have gone after, such as the emoluments or the war crimes that he's committed in our name, or even the human rights abuses of people on the border. But, of course, if they held Trump's feet to the fire, then they would have to hold Obama's feet to the fire for doing the exact same thing. So because they're benefiting from the system, the way it's set up of a controlled opposition, then we're not really going to see any difference until we start getting independent candidates into office on all levels.
So it sounds like you're not particularly fired up about the impeachment. Are you concerned that Trump will win another election? I mean, what do you think would happen if he did? And are you concerned about creeping demagogic fascism in public policy and discourse?
Well, absolutely. I believe fascism is creeping in, and it's being helped by the Democrats. I mean, they agreed to increasing his war budget by over $130 billion, and that could easily wipe out a lot of the student loan debt. That could end homelessness in the United States. That could feed, clothe, and house every child in America. And there's, because of the industrial war complex gaining such traction in our nation, there's the only opposition is really the independent candidates. As far as Trump winning again, I'm not sure. I had up until the day of the election. Well, I mean, 2 days before the election of 2016, I was finally convinced that Hillary might win. But where I live in Lawrence County, when Hillary ran in 2008, she won our county over Barack Obama by about 30 points. But when she came back to campaign in 2016, she did not win Lawrence County by any stretch of the imagination. So that, to me, told me that a lot of Democrats in my own home county were not interested in voting for Hillary. It just depends on the perception of the results of the Democratic elections and primaries of whether or not Trump is going to win. And, of course, if Bernie or any of the other Democrats were actually attacking the Democratic Party for their bad legislation and policies, then we might actually see a Democrat rise above and win. by a major landslide, but I just don't have any hope in either party. So,
well, now, what do you say then to someone like me? As I mentioned, I'm transgender, and of course, there have been several attacks on transgender persons' equal rights from the administration. For example, kicking us out of the military, making it licit for, well, actually legal for religious bigots to refuse services, including medical services, that sort of thing. When I see Trump, I see, you know, I see my life on the line. And since he has been elected, certainly things have changed for me. They've gone backwards, and I'm back to the way things were right at the turn of the century, where I had to be rather careful where I chose to, say, use a public restroom. What do you say to brown people who are affected by his demagoguery? What do you say to black people when it comes to whether Trump should be kicked out?
Well, Trump is a result of years and years of compromise and the Democratic Party moving further to the right. You know, a lot of this attack on the transgender community, the gay, lesbian community, is all about faith-based initiatives that George Bush started, that, you know, where religion is starting to dictate our governmental policies. So I am totally for a separation of church and state. Though I am a ordained Buddhist minister, I don't believe that my religion or anybody's religion should be used to hurt or hate anybody. So as far as you know, the issue with the transgender people being kicked out of the military, I have fully opposed that, because they've done something that Trump was never willing to do, which was to serve our country in a way that did not benefit them directly.
But for you, it seems that Trump is not an emergency.
Oh, I don't know if you know this, but we've been in a state of emergency for the last 20 years. So, I mean, Trump is just a final result of the Democrats moving to the right and the Republicans moving further to the right. Certainly it is an emergency, but there are lots of ways that we can counter it by creating partnerships and coalitions and creating citizen-based initiatives to overturn a lot of these issues, as well as taking them to court. A lot of the thing, unfortunately, the military thing is entirely within the purview of the executive office. And unfortunately, the Congress has handed Trump those powers, as well as had plenty of opportunity to repeal them, but they have not done anything. So the problem with Trump is the Democrats who support Trump and claim that they oppose him. Now, if they truly opposed him, they wouldn't vote to increase the war budget by over $130 billion to where we are now, with over $780-some billion going to war and less going to social services.
There is that bizarre and, to my mind, evil bipartisan consensus on promoting imperialism. I want to change the topic now and talk about Citizens United. Citizens United, the decision a few years back now, doubles down on the specious interpretation of the 14th Amendment to assert that corporations are people, and further asserts that money is speech. And, of course, this is upended. Well, I wouldn't say upended, but this is worsened corporate control of elections. And do you think there's support for a constitutional amendment to reverse that?
Absolutely. I support a constitutional convention where we rewrite the Second Amendment so that people who have been charged with domestic abuse and domestic violence, as well as other violent crimes, are prevented from getting weapons, as well as a reversal of Citizens United. You know, that basically told, you know, 70% of the country who are living in poverty that you don't have a voice in government and you don't have a right to speak when they equate speech with money. And once again, I blame this on the Democrats for not raising minimum wage when they had plenty of opportunities under Obama and had the Congress for 2 years, where they could have actually done some meaningful change. But instead, all they passed was right-wing legislation, and people now have the right to access health care, to pay for it, not a right to health care.
The Obama dilemma was something that was very much discussed here at this community radio station. Like, you can hope for change, but
yeah,
you can hope. Well, so it seems that the Citizens United decision has made reversing the Citizens United decision that much more difficult. You wrote that you will dedicate your campaign to the people, specifically the poor and working class Americans who barely make it paycheck to paycheck. This is who I am and who I intend to represent, end quote. I was pleased to see that because, after all, when you really do the numbers and you really compare what expenses are and what housing costs, half the nation is just barely scraping by. Half the nation would be devastated by the loss of one paycheck. So what does that mean to you that you'll dedicate your campaign to the people?
Well, I'm not taking any PAC money or endorsements. All my policy positions and everything that I'm campaigning for are for direct benefits to the people, such as the Medicare for all, ending all wars, a $25 an hour minimum wage. And we need to take care of the people. Corporations have had it too easy for too long. And I'm sick of additional tax breaks for the wealthy when, you know, we've seen over 40 years of failure of trickle down. I support instituting a tax that's called a failure to trickle down tax, which would be a reinstitution of the inheritance tax. If money is supposed to be earned, those who inherit it are not earning that money. And I don't care what somebody says, well, my father earned it, so he has the right to give it to me. Well, he has the right to give it to you while he's still alive. Otherwise, you know, it's our money. It's the people's money. Those taxes that you're not taking out of the money from the wealthy, those are taxes that could be used to rebuild our infrastructure, which is the fourth part of my campaign, of rebuilding a safer, cleaner, smarter infrastructure based on renewable energy, as well as, you know, repairing the problems that we had. I don't know if you remember back in 2012, I believe it was, Obama stood underneath a bridge in Cincinnati, Ohio, and was complaining about how much our infrastructure is crumbling. That bridge is still standing and is still crumbling.
Yeah, I think one could make that argument about Obama that he talked a good talk, but he didn't walk a good walk. Well, now let's talk about socialism a little bit more. With the Sanders campaign, people are talking more about socialism. While you were talking about taxes, I was thinking of the $13 trillion that is hidden offshore in corporate funds to avoid taxes. What's your policy towards that?
I would insist that they either bring that money back into the United States or that we tax them the equivalent amount so that they are forced to bring it back in. If they want to move their company somewhere else, you know, if corporations are people, they can die. So the best way to kill off a bad corporation is to remove its corporate charter from the United States and prevent them from operating within our country. And we can certainly do that if we can add tariffs to imports.
I have a mental image of shoving a corporate logo into a guillotine. Well, now, once again, I'm going to change.
Sounds like a good idea.
I want to talk about the horror at the border. You brought it up before. Do you support the idea of abolishing the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau, and how would that work out in terms of what would your administration do, and how would the USA treat its borders?
I'm all for tearing down the wall. It is an ecological disaster having that border wall out there. It prevents the migration of and the crossing of the natural habitat of the animals and that are in that area. You know, the statistics have shown that the people who cause the most damage, either through terrorism or economic issues, come to our nation legally and overstay their visas. So as far as abolishing ICE, I would shift its mission to more tracking those people, as well as helping create an actual system where people can gain citizenship. There is no system right now that exists in the United States for people to gain citizenship. There's, you know, they talk about a pathway to citizenship, but there is no actual pathway. There is no regulations stated by the federal government to tell you, here's the checklist of what you need if you want to become a citizen, and here's the time period.
25 after the hour. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Press Watch, and I'm speaking with Dennis Lambert, who's running for the Green Party nomination for president. I want to ask you now about your relation to the Green New Deal, your platform about climate change.
I don't believe in any new deals whatsoever, especially when the deck is stacked against the poor and working people. I mean, a new deal just means that you're going to shuffle the deck a little bit and everybody's going to get the same cards.
So you want something more radical?
Yes, such as my renewable infrastructure investment program, where we are actually directing money to communities to start their own initiatives on renewable energy. For example, just here in Ironton where I live, because we're right along the river, you know, I've run for Congress as well as for the State House. I know that along the Ohio River, there's currently 27 locks and dams, and only 19 of them generate electricity. But out of those 19, only two of them generate electricity beyond the locks and dams, and those are only generating electricity for parks that are next to those locks and dams. Now, if we created a system, and I know it's different up in the Northeast because you have salmon runs, and I'm all for eliminating the dams and shipping the salmon up the river by truck and allowing them to do what they're naturally, their nature intends them to do. But I would see money directed to communities to create electrical grid programs where they're investing either in solar, wind, water power, where it would generate electricity for that community, that the community would be responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of that, as well as employing the people to build, maintain, and work on those projects.
Okay, well, your website, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Those three things would help feed into an economy that would could virtually eliminate some taxes in a lot of these communities if they're generating electricity for themselves. And not only that, but it would create a hack-proof grid if they're a self-contained grid within a community that we don't have massive power outs where if a transformer goes out in Cleveland, New York City's not out of electricity.
Okay, and on your website it says, we must agree to fair treatment of all people. We're getting down to the bottom of the hour and wrapping up the interview now. So I want to ask you, does that mean addressing white supremacy in its social and economic forms?
Absolutely. I am the only candidate from any party who has called for a purge of white supremacists and racists from all levels of government, federal government.
I was talking more generally about white supremacy, about the hegemony that people like you and I enjoy over other people, over people of color.
Well, as somebody who grew up in poverty, I see white supremacy in action by you know, just observing life. Now, but as somebody who grew up in poverty, it's hard to exact any of that power that we have as a white person. But as far as I'm concerned, I've been doing all I can to raise awareness of issues of race that people aren't paying attention to. For example, a friend of mine said, well, you know, a black person can move anywhere they want to. I said, well, no, not with redlining. Now, if you were a black person in the 1950s and you tried to buy a house in certain parts of Chicago or any place else, you wouldn't be eligible for the loans based on your skin color. Now, because of that is generational, that has created a generational poverty within minority communities. And I try to use whatever white privilege I have to show people that, you know, it exists.
What about reparations then?
Oh, I co-authored a letter that was signed by five of the Green Party candidates for a demand for reparations. I fully believe that the reparations for slavery are due, and once we can get the reparations for slavery passed and paid out, then we can start talking about the reparations for the damages done to our environment, reparations for coal miners, as well as the massive industrial waste that's being pumped out into our communities, where we see now everybody and every human and every life form has some form of Teflon in their system.
Oh, yeah, I was just hearing about that. Well, that brings us to the bottom of the hour, and that is the end of the interview. Would you like to give a URL or a way of contacting you for your presidential run?
Yes, yes. My website is www.dlpotus2020.com. I also have a podcast that I put out weekly. It's I'm Dennis Lambert, and I'm running for president. Pretty easy to remember. And it's available on all platforms except for Stitcher. So it's on Apple Play, Google Podcasts, everywhere.
It is easy enough to find. Well, thank you very much for joining me, and I wish you the best of luck. And you are listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I've been speaking with Dennis Lambert, who is the third person that I have interviewed who is running for the Green Party nomination for president. This is Press Watch on KBOO Portland. It's 9:31 Pacific time. At 10 o'clock, we are going to be running Flashpoints, Dennis Bernstein's look at the impeachment hearings and the human rights tragedy of Central American asylum seekers. At 11, it's going to be Between the Covers with Ken Jones interviewing author and journalist Don Merrill. And that's our own Don Merrill, I believe. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, host SW Concerts in the studio with Tracy Francis, festival director for the Cascade Festival of African Films, who is once again bringing independent filmmakers to Portland from across the African continent. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support, and if you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. As I said, you're listening to Press Watch. I am Teresa Mitchell, and I have been live tweeting the impeachment trial. Before that, I was live tweeting some of the impeachment hearings in the House. And that is technically I wouldn't say not accurate, but not specific. It's the trial, not the impeachment has already happened. And so the president has been impeached, meaning that his crimes have been brought to the attention of the Senate, which has now gone to trial. And it's been an interesting process. I noticed that Adam Schiff was rather eloquent yesterday. I want to use the Guardian, the London Guardian's write-up on this as a base to put out some comments, and I want to ask for your comments on impeachment at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Now, as I usually say, the Guardian is a newspaper. It's in London, used to be the Manchester Guardian, and it's pretty good at criticizing the U.S. police state and U.S. politics generally. It's pretty good. I would not look for accurate reporting from them on British imperialism or on a whole list of other topics, but this is a pretty good article. So they write, striving to make himself heard across partisan lines, the lead impeachment prosecutor filed his opening argument against Donald Trump on the Senate floor yesterday with invitations, warnings, and appeals designed to win Republican backing for a substantial trial. Using flowing evocations of constitutional history, the global promise of U.S. democracy, and the stakes should all be allowed to slip, Democrat Adam Schiff framed his story of Trump's wrongdoing as a national crisis demanding a nonpartisan remedy. And departing from that, Schiff quoted Alexander Hamilton, which is interesting, and I believe he did make sort of oblique reference to the fact that the man was a slave monger. But he quoted Hamilton saying, when a man, and this is from Hamilton's reply when he was being harassed and brought to trial for his work as the Secretary of the Treasury. He wrote, when a man unprincipled in private life, desperate in his fortune, bold in his temper, possessed of considerable talents, having the advantage of military habits, despotic in his ordinary demeanor, known to have scoffed in private at the principles of liberty, when such a man is seen to mount the hobby horse of popularity, to join in the cry of danger to liberty, to take every opportunity of embarrassing the general government and bringing it under suspicion, to flatter and fall in with all the nonsense of the zealots of the day, it may justly be suspected that his object is to throw things into confusion, that he may ride the storm and direct the whirlwind, end quote. And that was stunning because, after all, that was, it seems to describe Donald Trump to a T, and it was written hundreds of years ago. Schiff was quoted saying, "I don't think the impeachment power is a relic. If it is a relic, I wonder how much longer our republic can succeed. If we don't stand up to this peril today, we will write the history of our decline with our own hand," end quote. And the Guardian writes, "But ahead of the trial's second full day, Republicans signaled no newfound curiosity about the case against Trump, who was impeached last month for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress in connection with an alleged scheme to pressure Ukraine into announcing investigations of his political rival Joe Biden. Republicans complained on Wednesday that the trial had not revealed any new evidence against the president. Less than 24 hours earlier, those same senators had voted four consecutive times against hearing from new witnesses." And I think they got that slightly wrong. They voted more times than that. "I didn't hear anything new today," said Republican Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. And Josh Hawley of Missouri was quoted saying, "I haven't heard any evidence in there that the president's done anything wrong," end quote. With the party's foe firmly ensconced in unique echo chambers, The Guardian writes, 4 months into the impeachment process, the likelihood that one argument or one piece of evidence or snippet of testimony could find a way through the partisan barrier seemed small. So your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. As I said, I followed it and live tweeted it. My Twitter handle is at KBU Press Watch. So I have bundled those, and you can find the bundles on Twitter and on Facebook. And on Facebook, I am Teresa Mitchell. I was Press Watch for a long time, and then someone busted me. Someone thought it was... I remember that someone just thought it was very important that Facebook's rules be enforced in that manner. And so I am Teresa Mitchell, and I'm sure you can figure out which one, going to Facebook. And once you find Teresa Mitchell on Facebook, if you would like to use the messaging service there to participate in this conversation, you can do that as well. But again, the number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And right now I'm talking about the impeachment process. They write, "Schiff and his fellow impeachment managers would need to persuade about 20 Republican senators to achieve their stated goal of removing Trump from office. But a much more modest number, 3 or 4 Republicans, would be enough for Democrats to call witnesses to the floor who might change the course of the proceedings." Schiff said, quote, "You are left with no choice but to demand to hear from each witness with firsthand knowledge. A fair trial requires nothing less," end quote. The historic wait attending the trial, only the third of its kind in U.S. history, was visible with a presence in the room of John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, and two tables of legal teams cramming the Senate chambers as well. The formality of the tableau was broken just once before a dinner break when a protester raised an incoherent cry in the balcony about abortion and Jesus Christ, and he was quickly ushered out. Roberts said, "The Senate will be in order," banging his gavel. "The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the gallery," end quote. And Roberts seems to be the stenographer-in-chief so far. He doesn't seem to be participating. There was some little hope that he would, as Chief Justice of the United States and someone who presumably is committed to process, if not fairness, in trials, that he would command the body to hear witnesses. The most obvious requirement for a trial, of course, and the main witnesses, as Trump boasted yesterday, the information is all in their hands, and John Bolton and Mulvaney and the other witnesses are being kept out. So right now in the process, the Democrats are laying out their case, and they're doing that. They will be doing that in about 20 minutes, and they'll be doing it all day and into the night. And then there will be the Republicans will get a chance to get up and convince themselves, even more than they're already convinced, that they're in the right and that it's all a sham and that they don't need to have any witnesses. So... I've decided to, I'm going to live tweet some more today, and I don't think I'll bother covering what the Republicans are going to say. Not only is it at least as predictable as what the Democrats are saying, it's just speciousness and toxic to watch. And it is difficult to watch that procedure And I know that people generally are not watching it. Just after 1 p.m., The Guardian writes, Schiff stepped to a lectern between the tables to narrate the story of Trump's wrongdoing. The managers would lay out the case in stages, he said, describing the details of Trump's corrupt scheme in narrative form with a factual chronology and video of past witness testimony, to move thereafter to a description of the constitutional framework for impeachment. At a break in the trial, the minority leader Chuck Schumer called Schiff's performance a tour de force. And I think, arguably, it was the best sustained effort that I had seen so far. It laid out the case. It was presented with passion and verve. And as I was saying to Dennis just now, this is an emergency for me, and I look to this process for whatever it is worth. Notice that after Clinton's impeachment, after the attempt to impeach Nixon, the credibility of the president was permanently damaged, and that would be a very good thing. This president, who, as we all know, is a vicious demagogue, a fascist proponent and champion of white supremacy in the United States, is an emergency for people like me, for transgender people like me, for people of color, for blacks, for indigenous people. This is an emergency, and so I'm following it for what it's worth, and hoping to get as much out of it as I possibly can, despite the fact that it is, and I will detail this a bit more in the coming minutes, a ridiculous process, not in the way that the Republicans say it is ridiculous. I mean, the Democrats are certainly accurate in saying that the president has broken the law and has obstructed Congress. This is creeping fascism. But I'll go to the first caller. Claudia is on the air. The number to call, 503-231-8187. Are you there, Claudia?
Yes, I am. My only comment is that I heard morning that some 20 seats in the Senate that were vacant all day long. In other words, 20 senators didn't show up for the trial.
They did show up, but they decided to wander off in defiance of the rules. Yes.
And so on. But senators can have papers and pencils, and senators have eyeballs. And they can write down where the vacant seats are and put it out on the web.
Okay, the audio coming in from your phone was rather garbled, but I think that you were pointing out that particularly the Republican senators made a mockery of the rules, rather harsh rules, that they stay there, pay attention to the extent that they could only have water or milk, of all things, on their desk. And I did see many glasses of water, and they're expected to sit there and take it very seriously. After all, this is a constitutional procedure. It has every bit as much weight as the constitutional procedure of electing a president, and it is the eraser on the pencil of the election of the president, and is to be undertaken only with great solemnity, since they will be, I mean, they will be, if Trump were convicted, it would be negating the will of that minority who elected him. The 63 million elected him, and 66 million voted for Clinton. That's a lot of people. And I have developed a great deal of contempt for those 63 million people, to tell you the truth, over the years. But nonetheless, it's a solemn thing. And I was a little shocked, not really surprised, but a little shocked to see that the Republicans just blew it off, and that Chief Justice Roberts didn't seem to give a damn. He had his cute little ivory gavel without a handle, and he tapped it smartly on the desk at the appropriate times, and otherwise did not preside in any substantial way. I've been calling him the stenographer in chief.
Good. But if you get the names of the senators who aren't showing up, who are blowing the trial off, and their names are made public, then there can be a groundswell.
Well, I should think it's not a good look, you know, to blow it off. But in the sneering, snarling, fascist atmosphere that Trump has drummed up over the last few years, maybe it works. Maybe it plays just fine with their constituency. Who can say? But I think you're right as far as that goes. Do you have anything further? Okay, well, thanks.
Anything that I can repeat on cable.
All right, well, thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 8187. This show is called Press Watch, and you're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio, in Portland, Oregon. And it is your station, and I would like to ask you for a couple of things. First, I would like you to tell someone that you think is interested and would care about the in-depth discourse that we have on these public affairs shows, and also tell someone who really likes different and new music about KBOO, 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM, and tell them about how they can get their favorite programs after the fact on the website or on the podcast servers. And this KBOO is also a podcast, and so you can find that on the podcast servers. Just look up KBOO Press Watch, and you'll be able to find this show. It'll post about half an hour after we're done here. And the other thing I would like to ask you to do, if you listen to KBOO, is to pull up KBOO.FM right now and tag us for a few bucks, because that's how we keep going, and that's what makes KBOO what it is. We do not drift from our mission, because we keep that vital aspect alive. We get our money, our operation expenses come in the greatest proportion from you. We don't allow big corporations to contribute. We don't allow ourselves to become dependent on grants and on government funds. We've had grants come and go here, and we're glad to get them when we do, but we depend on you. So, and those little contributions add up. They make a difference. And what I really like to see is for someone to tag us for 10 bucks a month. And if you pull up KBOO.FM, you'll see that we would like to give you the sort of gift that you expect from a community radio station. Will be available to you for that amount, or we still have the KBOO hoodie, and it's definitely time for that for 25 bucks a month. And KBOO.FM is how to do it, and you'll see the donation button at the top of the page. It's 9:47. I'm inviting your calls about impeachment, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I kind of want to talk to you about the meta of impeachment as well, not just the procedure, but about this, I would say, rather minimal and late attempt by the Democratic Party to set things a little bit right by bringing out this impeachment process. The thing that is powerful, not the thing, but a thing that is powerful about it, is that Trump has a habit, a very effective habit, in his demagoguery, and that is whenever he commits some crime, before people can really process what he has done, for example, banning Muslims or torturing children at the border, before people can get over the shock and actually intellectually process what's happening, he changes the subject. He has some new outrage to keep us all off our balance. And the thing about impeachment is it brings the same story every day. And you can see that it just drives him wild. He tweeted over 140 times yesterday. He can't stand it because he can't control the narrative while this is going on. He can't think of anything outrageous enough, just as of yesterday, to take the attention away from the fact that he got caught bribing the president of Ukraine. And that he is being called out for his outrageous and fascistic obstruction of the constitutional congressional impeachment process. Those are the two points of impeachment. And that's where it has some force. Necessarily, by this point, after months, even people who are resistant to the story are starting to become familiar with the bones of it, that the fool committed bribery, and that he is trying to create a new fascist imperial presidency that is not accountable through impeachment or through anything else. Returning to the writing of The Guardian, describing, in a recurring rhetorical trope, Schiff highlighted the evidence missing from the case owing to Trump's decision to defy subpoenas and block testimony, which prompted the obstruction of Congress charge. Describing a memo U.S. diplomat Bill Taylor wrote to the State Department after military aid to Ukraine was suspended, Schiff said, quote, "Would you like me to read that to you right now? I would like to read that to you, but I don't have it," end quote. On records of concerns filed by national security officials with in-house lawyers, Schiff said, quote, "Would you like me to read you that record? I would like to read you that record. It's there for the asking." If you keep getting told to go talk to the lawyers, Schiff said, there's a problem, end quote. So the seven House managers selected to present the articles of impeachment have about 16 remaining hours to spread over 2 days to present their case to convict and remove Trump from office. Then the president's team has the opportunity to rebut the charges. Trump is not expected to appear at his own trial, and the Republican-controlled Senate is forecast to acquit the president. Although I'd like to say regarding that, I noticed that there were some of the clips of Trump that were brought up on the screen during the process were rather quick, and I won't say they were out of context, but they were edited simply to make the point of the impeachment managers, and I thought that is surely going to vex Trump, and indeed it did. It was reported that Trump talked about going into the chambers himself just for his own personal satisfaction. Of course, that would be an incredibly stupid thing to do, and he seems to know it, or in any event, his lawyers do. I think it would be great because it would, I guess it would be bad because it would allow him to seize the narrative, but it's just not, it couldn't come out well for him because it is, as I said, a solemn procedure, and he's anything but solemn. There are a couple of recent events that got my attention that prompted me to think in terms of encroaching fascism. Not just in the impeachment trial, but the USA has not been free of fascism by any means. Certainly the extensive funding and operations of the various federal secret police agencies is a sign of fascism, and that's been with us for decades, since World War II particularly. But recently, Representative Ro Khanna succeeded in introducing an amendment to a general Pentagon funding bill that would have prevented exactly the sort of adventurism that resulted in the assassination of a top Iranian official, and the subsequent ballistic missile bombing of U.S.-occupied bases in Iraq. The Senate had agreed to the bill as amended. It was set to become law. Then officials from the Pentagon set upon the legislative body with such force that the amendment was withdrawn well after its legislative process had been completed. The result was that the military decided policy defining whether the USA would risk war or not, and that is backward, of course, from the intent of the Constitution, which sought to draw power from the people in general to the legislature to decide these affairs. It is not the mandate, and indeed it violates the mandate of the U.S. Armed Forces to set policy directing their actions. They are here to defend constitutional government, allegedly, not to subvert it to their own ends. But that incident was not isolated, and I was reminded of it when Republican Senator Mike Lee came blustering out, a Republican of all people, came blustering out of a Senate hearing room to reveal that when he was briefed by the Pentagon and Trump administration officials about the incident, they took the attitude that their words should not be challenged. From BuzzFeed News, Lee said that White House officials refused to provide details while warning senators that publicly debating the president's decision would only embolden Iran. He said, they're in the process of telling us we need to be good little boys and girls and not debate this in public. I find that absolutely insane. I think it's unacceptable, end quote. So that was rather shocking. But I have callers now. Time is 9:53, and Deanna is on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Thank you
for your wonderful show, as always. I have a question, and that is, while there is, of course, no comment period from the public on the impeachment trial, I'm wondering if, not on the basis of the outcome, you know, what should happen in terms of Donald Trump, but on the procedure and how all the Republicans who are covering for Trump are actually betraying all the American people in so doing, because exactly as you pointed out, this is a serious legal operation, political overtones aside, and they are defying it, and I think it's not too much to call them traitors. I'd like your comments about whether people in the streets demanding that the Republicans bring forth witnesses would be effective to any degree. Thank you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it would be effective if they thought that they might immediately lose their seats. That would be some pretty ferocious protests.
Mm.
And I'm glad that you bring up this this sort of meta, though, because what's really happening here is the Republicans won the presidential election and a great deal of their seats and the majority in the Senate through dirty tricks, basically. And that is a core part of their party now, they are the minority, and people, white cisgender males, evangelicals, are actually a minority, if you think about it. There isn't any majority when you divide it up that way. When you divide the men and the women, when you look at the various groups that elect a president or don't, there isn't any one group. I mean, certainly white cis males have hegemony, but they don't. They're not more than 25-26% of the population. So they realize that they can lose that hegemony. They can lose that. And so Trump has been very successful in being the champion for white supremacy. And right. I noticed when I said white supremacy earlier, the candidate I was talking to immediately thought I was talking about overt white supremacists. No, I'm talking about the hegemony that white people like myself have over other people in the society. And Trump has been very effective in directing that fearful desire to hold the system as it is. And that's very powerful. That's what it's really about. And so the Republican senators won't budge. They hate Trump. You know, they despise him. But they're not going to budge because they realize that once they let go of their dirty tricks, then the majority is going to crush them, and they're going to have to answer for the things that they've done.
So, in other words, they are counting on that cult of loonies that support Trump to support them.
Yeah, it's a very unbalanced thing. It's like you can see that it has to come down at some point, and they're trying to delay that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm just, you know, you have such a, I think I could say, I don't know, an eagle's eye view, there's maybe a better word, on what's going on. And so I thought I would put that out, because certainly I think it's an angle of attack for the American people to rise up in outrageous, you know, righteousness and say, hey, you are really screwing with us.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your call. I think there's one person waiting. No,
yeah,
there's not.
You.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in. All right, so now we're getting towards the top of the hour. I've been talking about the impeachment procedures and trying to talk about what it means in terms of where the society is heading. When I went across the country in September and in early October, in my 20-year-old Saturn with my partner, I noticed that conditions across the country are such that people are desperate to keep even jobs at the Sonic drive-in. I remember stopping at a couple of drive-ins whenever we had to get fast food, as we, you know, tried to get across the country in a reasonable amount of time. Notice that there's a tension that comes from the boss being harsh, wanting to extract the maximum from the workers, and that the context that allows that is not being able to get a job somewhere else. And I thought it was kind of pitiful. There's one Sonic drive-in particular that I stopped at, and I remember they thought at some point that they had made an error on their order, and they were just freaked out about it. And I thought, why do they care? And then I realized that this is one of the few lousy jobs available in the podunk town I was passing through. This is what Americans are facing. This is what half of us have to put up with to one degree or another. The society, the economy is not supporting us, and we have been betrayed by our leadership. Well, I thank you for listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. It's 9:58, and as I was saying at the top of the hour, we are going to have Flashpoints, an excellent program with Dennis Bernstein looking at the impeachment hearings and the human rights tragedy of Central American asylum seekers. You've been listening on KBOO 90.7 FM in our great big red and white Eiffel Tower on the hill, on the West Hills, and via KBOO.FM going out to all the ships at sea.